Hello, welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. We've got a remarkably close vote in a former Soviet republic to tell you about, along with the death of a hugely influential and controversial Muslim cleric, and also why a group of professional women football players are angry with their governing body. That's all to come. But we're going to begin in Lebanon, where the US is making a renewed effort to rein in the war between Israel and the Hezbollah militia, a war which appears only to be intensifying and widening. That renewed effort is being led by President Biden's special envoy, Amos Hochstein. Shortly before he arrived in Beirut, the Israeli Air Force had hammered targets in the capital and in southern Lebanon, apparently targeting branches of a bank Israel accuses of financing Hezbollah. We'll hear more about that in a moment. Speaking at the start of his visit, though, Mr. Hochstein sounded deeply downbeat.
This is a really heartbreaking moment for me to be here in Lebanon. The people of Lebanon, like everyone in the region, just want to go home, build a peaceful, secure, and safe and prosperous future for themselves and their families. This is my sixth or maybe seventh visit to Lebanon in the past year. And while we spent 11 months containing the conflict, we were not able to resolve it. In each of my visits, I cautioned that the situation was urgent and the status quo was not sustainable. We were either going to reach a solution or things were going to escalate out of control. I stood at this very podium, time after time, including as recently as August, and cautioned about the urgency. A resolution was possible, but it was rejected, and the situation has escalated out of control as we feared that it could.
Hezbollah started firing missiles into Israel back on October the 8th last year, a day after the Hamas massacres which prompted Israel's devastating war in Gaza. The conflict between Israel and Hezbollah escalated dramatically a few weeks ago, with the Israeli military and security services launching a series of grievous blows against Hezbollah militants and their commanders. In that time, hundreds of thousands of Lebanese have been displaced. Thousands of their compatriots have been killed. What's the answer? It is, said the US envoy Amos Hochstein, the long-standing UN Security Council resolution which ended the last Israel-Lebanon war.
As President Biden said, our goal is a comprehensive agreement that implements UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and ensures this conflict is the last for many generations. 1701 was successful at ending the war in 2006, but we must be honest that no one did anything to implement it. The lack of implementation over those years contributed to the conflict that we are in today. That must change, because both sides simply committing to 1701 is just not enough.
The US envoy Amos Hochstein speaking today. Also in Beirut is our correspondent Jonathan Head. Jonathan, much to cover with you, but just on what Hochstein said, the tone he said it in as well, he just seemed, I don't know, frustrated, despondent.
Yeah, well, he's a man who claims to have a great love of Lebanon. He's been here many times going over many years. So I think he's probably genuinely, personally distressed by what this country is suffering. And he knows, of course, that at this stage, the ingredients for a ceasefire or a peace are not there. We have to assume this is, you know, now we've had 4 weeks of this dreadful bombardment here, and Israel determined to keep the momentum going, to do all it can to destroy Hezbollah not giving up. This is not a time where either side has shown even the slightest inkling or interest in peace. It's possible that Mr. Hochstein got different messages from Nabi Berri, the Speaker of Parliament, who's his intermediary with Hezbollah. He's an ally of Hezbollah. It's possible he might have heard something encouraging, but you're not seeing the Israeli side willing to stop yet when its goal is to damage Hezbollah so badly that it can't be threatened anymore. They can't fire rockets. They can't threaten northern Israel. We just don't know at what point you could say that. So I think it's the start of a process. And I think, you know, he's simply listening to all sides to see if the ingredients are there just to begin looking for compromise.
And Jonathan, we heard certainly at the start of your answer the background to so much of what you've been saying in recent days, which is the sound of an Israeli drone overhead. Tell me about the latest attacks, in particular this targeting of this bank, which the Israelis say is the one that finances Hezbollah.
Yeah, that drone's still there. It's like a sort of, apart from the noise of the traffic as well, it's very surreal, but ordinary life going on around you, and you have a drone buzzing around ahead, and of course always a sinister presence when we've had warnings from Israel that it's on a new stage of its campaign. This is the first time Israel has explicitly said we're now targeting non-military infrastructure of Hezbollah. It gave these warnings last night that it is going to try to destroy the financial underpinnings of Hezbollah, this bank network, Al-Qaeda al-Hassan, which has, I think, 36 branches around the country. And very soon after that, explosions right across southern Beirut. That is where Hezbollah is strongest in the capital. And in the morning we've seen that, you know, I think there were 16 attacks in all of those. Either bank branches were destroyed or buildings associated, that we seem to have gone from bombing bunkers to bombing bank branches now. And that all suggests that Israel has a lot more it needs to destroy in this attempt to not just diminish Hezbollah, but it looks like they're trying to diminish its entire influence in Lebanese society. Because remember, the point about these banks is, yes, they fund weapons purchases and pay fighters, according to the Israelis, but they also, they give welfare payments to ordinary Lebanese. And I think Israel is trying to find a way to diminish Hezbollah's entire influence, which is so strong here in Lebanon.
Jonathan Head, our correspondent in Beirut, thank you very much. Vast numbers of Lebanese have been caught up in this conflict, along with the dead and the injured, many of them non-combatants. There are vast numbers who've been displaced. Leading the efforts to staunch the damage is Imran Reza, the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Lebanon.
The word we've been using to describe it is really catastrophic. What's happened over the last few weeks is basically a situation that was always gradually escalating over the course of 11 and a half months from October 8th of last year, resulted in those 11 and a half months with about 110,000 people displaced. Now we have well over about 800,000 displaced just in the last few weeks. It's increased to that. We have over 400,000 that have crossed to Syria, you know, going on 1.5 million people that have been severely affected by this. So the needs are great, huh? And it is really a humanitarian catastrophe that we're facing.
And this, of course, in a country which was not in a robust state to deal with further setbacks.
To say the least, the last 5 years in Lebanon have been unprecedented. The impoverishment that happened over those 4 or 5 years from 2019 onwards affected much of the population of Lebanon, and also the institutions, the government, the entities that are supposed to be helping this population in need.
What about getting relief in? Because although the airport itself has not yet been directly targeted, areas quite close to the airport have been by the Israeli Air Force. And am I right in thinking that the airport is perhaps the key route in for international aid supplies?
Yeah, now certainly the airport and also the ports, the seaports, both are equally important. For the time being, as you were saying, the airport remains open. It is critical. And of course, that's part of our key messaging to member states that have influence and certainly to the parties to ensure that the airport remains open, that humanitarian supplies can get in.
I mean, clearly, southern Lebanon and parts of southern Beirut have been particularly intensely targeted. But are all parts of Lebanon under threat of one sort or another?
In the first part, it was mainly the south It was the Bekaa. It was, on occasion, the southern suburbs. What we've seen in the last few weeks is really quite a massive level of destruction in the south, a lot of strikes on the southern suburbs, and strikes in other parts in the north of Lebanon just the other day. So this is, of course, creating a great deal of panic amongst the population, a great deal of trauma, and a real sense of not knowing where to go to find safety.
The Israelis say that, look, these evacuation orders that they've issued and issue pretty much daily to parts of Lebanon are intended precisely to spare those who are non-combatants, who are not involved with Hezbollah. It is Hezbollah which has deliberately enmeshed itself in the middle of communities, and that the Israeli operations are, in their words, targeted, precise and limited. How far do you think that that sort of explain why there has been such levels of distress and displacement among the Lebanese?
What I can say about that is simply that the civilian impact of this has been enormous. You were mentioning evacuation orders. It's about a quarter of the country that's under these. And there have also been strikes on areas where there have not been evacuation orders. Just last night, in the middle of the night, there were a number of these orders in different parts of the country, including a number of different areas in Beirut. And so when people get this at 5 in the morning, there is a certain level of panic and confusion as to where they can go.
And presumably the major thing that will bring immediate relief to the people of Lebanon is there to be a ceasefire negotiated. It still feels like a very distant prospect at this juncture, doesn't it?
It is. I mean, even today there are visits happening here and people are discussing it, but we've been discussing it for a long time and we have consistently been calling. I mean, there is no military solution to this. There is no humanitarian solution. It has to be a political, diplomatic solution. And to move towards that, you need a ceasefire. And you need that ceasefire as quickly as possible. The other thing that we need is basically respect of international humanitarian law. The number of frontline workers, the number of health workers, the number of civilians that have been affected by this and killed in all these hostilities has been overwhelming. And that needs to stop.
And that was the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for Lebanon, Imran Riza, speaking to me from Beirut. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. Coming up on the programme, 15 days to the US presidential election. How far could abortion swing the result in the battleground state of Arizona?
It just shouldn't be something you should be voting on. Like, there's, I don't know why we're going back in time. I really don't understand it.
Well, I'm happy that our government, our state, local, federal government steps in sometimes and creates laws to protect vulnerable people.
That report from Arizona coming up in 30 minutes. Headlines this hour. The president of Moldova has warned that a surprisingly tight referendum on EU membership featuring allegations of Russian vote buying is a wake-up call on defending democracy. We'll hear from the foreign minister of Moldova in 15 minutes. And a US special envoy in Lebanon has said that talks are underway to end the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah once and for all. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London with me, Tim Franks. A civil trial in London has opened today into the world's largest mining company, BHP, over a dam collapse in Brazil 9 years ago. The dam was connected to the operations of a mine run by a company called Samarco, a joint venture between the mining giants BHP and Vale. Toxic mud and waste flooded the nearby area in November 2015, killing 19 people and leaving hundreds homeless. Nearly 700,000 people are now taking the companies to international courts in London and the Netherlands, respectively. The companies deny liability, but say that they've already funded nearly $8 billion in repairs and compensation. With more, here's our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
Mariana is a quaint historic town in the mountains of southeast Brazil. Its windy cobbled streets and soundtracks of birds and church bells make for a peaceful setting. But 9 years ago, it was making headlines, the scene of Brazil's worst environmental disaster.
19 people are still missing after the rupture of two...
One person has been confirmed dead, but at least a dozen are reported to be missing.
The last words I heard from him was he saying to me, "Mom, did you know that you are the best mom in the world?"
I'm at the house now of Giovanna Rodriguez. Her son, Thiago, was 7 years old when he was killed in the dam collapse.
When the disaster happened, he was in the next town, where he stayed with his grandmother so I could work. I heard the news, I ran there, and I saw everything destroyed. 7 days and seven nights passed before I heard that they had found the body.
I'm in Bento Rodriguez now, which is one of the towns that was completely destroyed by the disaster. It's now basically a ghost town. Most of the houses here are complete ruins. Some of them still have mud all the way up the walls.
Minha casa, igual falei com vocês, né? Aqui.
Marcos Muniz, known as Marquinhos, is one of the people who used to live in this town. His house was completely washed away in the disaster. You can now only just see the tip of it poking out of the brown water.
Cheguei em Bento.
I arrived here when I was 6 with my family. Then my dad bought the land where I built my house when I was older. I knew that here I would have the livestock, pigs and orange trees. Now the house that I inherited from my father is inside the lake there. We were raised here.
Protests still take place regularly in Mariana. At this one, a group of people are gathering outside a court with banners, with megaphones, protesting against what happened. Vale and BHP have set up a foundation called the Renova Foundation, responsible for compensating people. They've given people the option of money or a new house in a new city that they've constructed. I'm there now, and there are still some homes being built, but hundreds have been built already. They're big, modern houses, but it is a different feel in this community to the old Bento Rodriguez. Daísa das Graças used to run a small bar in the old Bento Rodriguez. She now runs a restaurant called Bar da Una in the new city and lives here as well.
I preferred life before. The community was more united. It's a little different now, because not everyone is coming here.
Fernanda Lavarello is the head of corporate affairs at BHP Brazil.
What happened in 2015 was a tragedy. Since then, BHP never abandoned the country, and BHP is here since the beginning, since the one doing everything we can to repair the environment and the life of those families. Some processes are taking longer than expected, but that is quite complex. But the families that choose quickly to build their house are ready and they already move it here.
For Giovanna, nothing can compensate for losing her son.
It's impossible, impossible, because nothing can bring a life back. There is no money in the world that can buy a life.
That report from Ione Wells in Brazil. Sport draws sponsorship from all quarters. Sponsors want the glamour and the publicity. Sports want the money. But there are tensions when those sponsors are deemed to be controversial. Today, Gianni Infantino, the boss of football or soccer's world governing body, FIFA, has received a letter from more than 100 professional women players which begins, and I quote, "Dear President Infantino, Aramco sponsorship is a middle finger to women's football." Aramco is Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil giant. Saudi has invested vast amounts into lots of high-profile sports in recent years, but continues to face criticism over its treatment of women and the criminalisation of LGBTQ relationships. FIFA insists that the money it receives from Aramco is ploughed back into the women's game. I've been hearing more from Sophie Junge-Petersen, a Danish professional footballer who's one of the chief signatories to the letter. She told me why.
We in women's football think that we stand for a lot of great values like gender equality, LGBT plus rights and human rights in general. And we have really been fighting for those things through a long time. So that's why we think that these values are so important for us. And this is something that don't align with this sponsorship with Saudi Aramco.
So I guess the answer to that, and it's the one that we've heard from FIFA, the world governing body, is that, look, you may have concerns about Saudi Arabia's human rights record, but Saudi Aramco is putting money into the women's game. It is benefiting the women's game from the grassroots up, and that can only be a good thing in terms of, for example, gender equality.
I think we need to ask ourselves what we want to be part of. Receiving money from a sponsor like Saudi Aramco, whose owner, who's the Saudi state, is committing human rights violations towards its own people. That's not the right thing to be part of. And we hear many human rights organizations who tells that this is a strategy from the Saudi state to use sport as a way to beautifying the picture of the situation in Saudi Arabia.
Would you accept the argument put forward by some outside FIFA, outside Saudi Arabia? Some say, look, the situation in Saudi is improving. I mean, albeit from a low base. But for example, when you think about women's involvement in the workforce, women's involvement in various quarters of Saudi life, it is getting better. Saudi Arabia is on a journey.
I acknowledge that there have been steps forward, like there is a league for women's football now in Saudi Arabia and that women are allowed to drive. But there are still so many things that are not going in the right direction. And the fact that women and men can be put to prison simply just for speaking up about human rights and being sentenced to decades of prison, that's just horrifying. And with the words of Lina Al-Hadloul, a Saudi activist from the organization ALQST, she says that it's okay to applaud a few things going forward, but at the same time express concern for these severe violations against human rights. That's what we are doing now.
In a sense, you only have a certain amount of power. I mean, you're a member of a club team and your national team. It's difficult for you to influence the course of events. What's the next step for you?
Now we have sent this letter and we hope to get a dialogue with FIFA. We really believe and hope that FIFA will come forward and answer our questions.
When you say believe and hope, though, I mean, FIFA's record on this, I'm not sure where you would derive that hope from. I mean, they haven't said no to many sponsorship deals that I can think of.
That's true. I think I'm a positive person who believes in the best until something else is proven to me. I really hope that FIFA will answer these questions.
And that was Sophie Junger-Peterson. We did contact Aramco and FIFA for interviews. Neither was able to provide one. Welcome back to NewsHour. Poisoned with the nerve agent Novichok in 2020, the Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny died in February in a Russian penal colony in the Arctic Circle. President Biden pointed the finger at Vladimir Putin. With Navalny's memoir Patriot about to be published, our culture editor Katie Razzle met his widow, Yulia Navalnaya.
Everything has changed in my life. Everything has changed in our children's life. He was really not just a husband. He was the best friend.
And Alexei died on February the 16th, 2024, in one of Russia's most brutal prisons in the Arctic Circle. What do you believe happened to your husband?
I believe that Vladimir Putin is answering for the death and for the murder of my husband. We do have some evidence.
What evidence do you have?
I would like to come with the whole picture, what happened, not just with the random documents. Probably it will take a lot of time because he was in this cell alone. So, of course, it's very difficult to investigate all this.
When you say President Putin answers for your husband's death, is that what you mean, that President Putin ordered this?
Of course. I mean that he ordered this.
Now, the book contains diaries that Alexei wrote in prison. These diaries have never been seen before, certainly publicly. How did you feel reading your husband's prison diaries?
We exchanged a lot of letters when it was possible. So I knew even before diaries that he was tortured and he was starving.
And in the book, we read about him spending 295 days in solitary confinement.
And usually the normal practice is punishment just for 2 weeks. And my husband spent there almost 1 year.
Alexei was poisoned with Novichok, a nerve agent, in Siberia back in 2020. He was eventually evacuated to a German hospital for treatment. And you decided, the pair of you, once he was better, to go back to Russia in January 2021, even though he knew the regime had already tried to kill him. Just explain why.
It's not about we decided. It's about that you believe to a person with whom you live so many years. I knew that he wants to be with his supporters, to be an example for all these people with his courage, with his bravery. There are a lot of people who support me, and I want to be supportive to them back.
And can you see yourself standing ever to be president of Russia? Is that your goal now?
My goal is to make all these changes happen. If I will come back to Russia, I will participate in the elections.
As a candidate?
As a candidate.
Katie Razzle speaking to Alexei Navalny's widow, Yulia Navalnaya. You are the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London. We're heading deep now into Eastern Europe, to Moldova, the country tucked between southwestern Ukraine and northeastern Romania. It's a former Soviet republic, and that is absolutely key, because Moldova on Sunday held a referendum on whether to change the constitution to make joining the European Union an official national aim. And it's a vote which has been squintingly close. Pro-EU voters appear to have secured a fraction over 50% of the vote. The authorities in the capital, Chisinau, have accused Russia of being behind a big vote-buying operation for the no vote. Sarah Rainsford is our Eastern Europe correspondent and is in Moldova. Sarah, the polls suggested it was going to be an easy win for the government. What's the evidence of why it became such a tight vote?
Yeah, they did, didn't they? It was supposed to be a comfortable win for Maia Sandu, the president here, who actually called this referendum, I think, because she thought it was going to be an easy ride, essentially. This is a country which, in its fairly big majority, actually supports joining the EU. And what she was asking them to vote on was a decision to kind of enshrine that national choice within the constitution. The point being she wanted to make it irreversible, and the sort of broader point to all that being that since the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine, Maia Sandu has turned Moldova very sharply away from Vladimir Putin's Russia and much more directly towards closer partnership with the West. So that is the very important context to all of this, because the vote was extremely close and because Maia Sandu now is quite clearly coming out and calling this a dirty fight. She's calling it a vile attack on our sovereignty. She's saying that the result was what it was because there were, as she called it, criminal gangs and foreign forces who were buying up votes in Moldova in order directly to twist this result, essentially to get people to vote against the EU and against her. Now, that is based on evidence that's come from police and prosecutors. It's not just the president saying that. We have seen a good amount of that evidence. And certainly the case that the justice system here is making is that money has been channeled from Russia to Moldova, and that as many as 130,000 people may have accepted bribes, essentially, to place their vote.
Sarah Rainsford, we'll leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us from Chisinau, the capital of Moldova. It was, as Sarah was saying, a very, very narrow victory and a very, very loud sigh of relief in the Moldovan government. Mihai Popșoi is the country's foreign minister. He's also deputy prime minister. Is he absolutely confident that his side did indeed win?
We are very much confident that we have won. It has been indeed a close election, but it is yet again a confirmation that every single vote counts. And we've been really honored to see this enormous mobilization, both at home, but especially in the diaspora, of citizens who want to see their country prosperous and peaceful and part of the European family of nations. So no matter how much the Kremlin tried to influence and impact negatively this election, no matter the hybrid tactics that have been used and the money that have been poured to bribe voters and to destabilize Moldova, the citizens have spoken loud and clear. It has been a historic turnout, and an absolute majority of Moldovan citizens have spoken in favor of European integration.
Well, much to pick out of that. One thing was you saying that Russia has poured in money to try and, your word, bribe voters. I mean, that is obviously a crime, to try and buy a vote. Do you have hard evidence of that?
We do, and there are a number of criminal cases pending in our law enforcement. But also there was an incredible display of investigative journalism by one of the main newspapers here in Moldova, by a young and courageous journalist who was embedded in this organized criminal group undercover for a couple of months. And she actually recorded every single thing of how this organized criminal group operates in Moldova with money coming from Russia. But also our law enforcement is becoming more adept in dismantling these networks. But of course, it takes time through the justice system for these actors to be actually prosecuted.
And have you any idea or indeed any evidence on what scale what you are alleging took place?
Well, our intelligence service and police have assessed in the last few weeks that it's about 130,000 people that are part of this network that are susceptible to be corrupted. But lately, the number could be as high as 300,000 that we've seen in the aftermath of the election. But this has not been enough to actually sway the outcome. Despite the enormous suffering that Moldova has gone through and the economic struggle that we've endured, the vast majority of Moldovans have still remained clear-cut in what they see best for their children in the future, and where do they see their country?
Yeah, except, I mean, it's not that clear-cut, really, is it? I mean, I know that you're saying, look, there was a big vote-buying and disinformation campaign that you were up against, but nonetheless, victory has been by a wafer-thin majority, assuming the figures hold up. But also, in the accompanying vote on the presidency, the president whom you support, she got a lot less than was forecast. I mean, she now goes into a runoff with somebody who is seen as being perhaps closer to Moscow. It suggests that actually people in Moldova are withholding judgment.
In fact, the forecasts have been largely confirmed. President Sandu did incredibly well, considering the struggles that the country has gone through. And she's been able to steer the Republic of Moldova very firmly into the free world and to maintain peace and stability in the Republic of Moldova and provide enormous support to the Republic of Moldova from the development partners that she's been able to build considerable trust with. So the fact that she has about 43% and the second place is about 26%, that's a very big disparity. And that is a vote of confidence for President Sandu and for our team.
I wonder if in moments of cool reflection, you and others will think, actually, maybe it was a bit of a mistake to bring this referendum, because you didn't need to. And it feels as if it's rather backfired. And what you've done is just show up how divided the country is.
Not really. We've shown that the country is united behind European integration. You know, the Republic of Moldova is in a very turbulent region, and we have many pro-Russian proxies in the political space in Moldova. But everybody will be bound by the will of the people to be part of the European family of nations. This is a strategic goal that has been vindicated and validated by the majority of Moldovan citizens in a very high turnout, against all odds, against enormous interference from the Kremlin, and in very difficult security and economic circumstances. So if you factor all that in, this is a resounding success.
And that was Mihai Popșoi, Moldova's foreign minister and deputy prime minister. Fethullah Gülen, the Turkish cleric who's died at the age of 83, was a man around whom lots of adjectives accrued. Influential was one, also reclusive, enigmatic. To his supporters, and in his heyday, he counted tens of millions of them in Turkey and beyond. He was inspirational to his critics, and to this day he has them at the highest levels of Turkish government. He was malign. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan blamed Gülen and his global Hizmet movement for being prime movers in the attempted coup of 2016. Gulen denied involvement, but the Turkish authorities carried out a sweeping crackdown against vast numbers of his followers or those accused of secretly following him. When I said before he was reclusive, well, back in 2014, I managed, through the work of one of the producers on our NewsHour team, to secure an interview in person with Mr. Gulen. It was his first broadcast interview in his self-imposed exile in the US for 16 years. This is what he had to say about allegations of corruption within the Turkish government and repression of his supporters.
I don't know where to begin. It is certain that there is corruption. Everyone accepts this, from the uneducated to the educated to the elites. Everyone sees and knows what is going on. But I believe that these things being done against the movement today are also causing Turkey to lose, because these government actions are anti-democratic, because these government actions are against the rule of law. Almost everyone is saying this today.
Galip Dalai is Senior Consulting Fellow and Specialist on Turkey with the London-based think tank Chatham House. Galip, very good to have you on the programme. It's a long and rich life, so we'll have to canter through it. But, I mean, it's worth pointing out that this Hizmet movement under Gulen was actually an ally of Recep Tayyip Erdogan's to start out with.
Well, during the first decade of the Erdogan in power, the AK Party in power, they were an ally. They were an ally, particularly in the face of the previous Kemalist establishment. But once the Kemalist establishment, the previous Turkish establishment, lost power in the system, basically the Gulenists were trying to act as a state within the state, and that put them on a collision course with the government. They disagree almost over everything, like from foreign policy to security policy. They were trying to basically chart the course of Turkish foreign and security policy, from the Kurdish peace process to the education system. And that basically put the government and them on a collision course. And to be honest, actually, the many of the Turkish opposition circle were also quite strongly anti-Gulenist. So it's not only the government, so it's from the pro-Kurdish party to the opposition to many liberals. There's a very strong, large section of the society that is quite anti-Gulenist, and the power that they wielded within the judiciary, within the military, which basically culminated in a coup d'etat on 15 July 2016.
And what was the evidence that the Gulenists were behind that coup?
Well, I think there is many confessions that is being going on. There is like many people that have been arrested. Quite a significant number of them are in one way or another related to the Gulen movement. So obviously, I don't have the full details of all the intelligence details, but the evidence is sizable. The evidence is quite sizable that the Gulenists were behind the coup attempt, and that is also very widely shared view in Turkey by opposition and the government alike.
Right, and it was an absolutely massive purge of Gulenists or people who were accused of being Gulenists after 2016. I mean,
yes.
Tens of thousands were detained, tens of thousands lost their jobs.
Yes.
Given the level of the crackdown, how much, and given, of course, now that Fethullah Gulen has died, how much influence does the Hizmet movement still have in Turkey?
Well, the Gulenists, I don't think that they wield as much influence as they used to do, because quite many of them also left Turkey. They live in Europe, the US, or elsewhere. So I don't think that they wield a significant power, and not that the Gulen himself died. So there's probably a very good chance that the group will splinter, so we will have different factions. So I don't think that there's anyone as charismatic that can keep the group united. So we will probably see, going forward, more split up within the group, more confessions, more accusation, more also infighting over the resources, networks of the group, because they had massive presence from the media to education system. They had like schools for more than 160, 170 around the world, the business networks. So probably we'll see a split up, probably we'll see an infighting. I don't think that they can ever retain the same level of influence in Turkey as once they used to do, because okay. Not only the government, as I said, the opposition is
Galip, we'll have to leave it there, but thanks very much for joining us. Galip Dalai. This is the BBC World Service and NewsHour, and it is just over 2 weeks to the US presidential election, and polls are consistently tight in the handful of battleground states that will decide the outcome. Among voters' top concerns in this election are immigration, the economy, and abortion. In the swing state of Arizona, that issue, abortion, is being hotly contested with a ballot initiative, in effect a statewide referendum that would protect abortion rights. Joe Biden won Arizona by just 10,000 votes in 2020. Our North America editor Sarah Smith sent us this report from Maricopa County.
Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
Abortion opponents are maintaining daily vigils outside family planning clinics as they urge people to vote against the proposal that would protect abortion rights. And abortion has proved to be a winning issue for Democrats ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned 2.5 years ago.
Right. If you don't want to have an abortion, you don't need to have an abortion.
This divisive issue is now being argued out on the streets. Outside the clinic, we came across Anai, a young woman taking on the anti-abortion campaigners over reproductive rights.
It just shouldn't be something you should be voting on. Like, there's, I don't know why we're going back in time. I really don't understand it.
Anai was debating local campaign leader Nancy Brady.
There are a lot of people on the other side of the argument from you who would say each abortion is a deeply personal decision for the woman and her family, and the government shouldn't have anything to do with it.
Well, I'm happy that our government, our state, local, federal government steps in sometimes and creates laws to protect vulnerable people. I am very grateful for that.
You will no longer be thinking about abortion. It's all they talk about, abortion.
Donald Trump plays this issue really carefully.
Because we've done something that nobody else could have done.
He does boast about his role in ending the right to abortion, but he also tries not to sound like he supports the very strict bans that he knows are unpopular with most voters.
It is now where it always had to be, with the states and a vote of the people.
Here in Arizona, opinion polls suggest that Donald Trump does have a very slight lead, even though a majority of voters are likely to support restoring abortion rights. As many as 1 in 5 may well vote in favor of abortion, and also cast a vote for the former president. And this in a state that Joe Biden won by only 10,000 votes in 2020.
Tonight we are learning more about the death of Amber Thurman.
The death of Amber Thurman was likely preventable.
Campaign ads for Kamala Harris feature the case of Amber Thurman, a young woman who died 2 years ago. A strict abortion ban in her home state of Georgia meant that when she wanted one, she had to travel hundreds of miles to North Carolina to get a termination. 5 days later, Amber went into hospital with complications, and she got worse over the next 20 hours. She ultimately died in surgery. A recent review by an official state committee concluded Amber's death was preventable, and had doctors treated her sooner, she would likely have survived.
But she was always a very strong person. Pain never really bothered her.
Her best friend, since they were 5 years old, Ricaria Baker, had driven with Amber to North Carolina to terminate her pregnancy.
Every day, it's hard. This is somebody that I did life with every day. I talked to her every day. I'm never going to get my best friend back because of something that could have been prevented. And I would hope that nobody else have to feel this pain of losing a best friend this way.
Ricaria Baker, ending that report by Sarah Smith. We are at a tipping point, a make or break moment. How often have we heard those warnings about climate change? Well, today a similar warning will be sounded on an issue intimately linked with climate change, but which tends to get rather less attention, and that is biodiversity. A UN summit, called in the jargon COP16, is about to open in the Colombian city of Cali. The last COP 2 years ago in Montreal was seen at the time as a great success, supposedly committing almost 200 countries to 23 targets to protect biodiversity. There are very big questions, though, as to how far those commitments have been met. The vast majority of countries have yet even to deliver their own detailed national action plans. I've been speaking to the head of development at the UN Development Programme in Colombia, Jimena Puyana.
The COP16 that is celebrating now in Cali, Colombia, is very, very important because it's the main meeting of the parties in the world to talk about biodiversity. In this COP, there will be discussing several important things to tackle the biodiversity crisis, like, for example, how these countries have advanced in their or have progressed in the commitments that they made 2 years ago in Comín, Montreal, when they reached an agreement on the global biodiversity framework. So in this COP, governments are going to present to the world how well they are doing or how bad they are doing.
Well, also, just on that, Ximena, sorry to interrupt. I mean, you say they're going to present how well they're doing or how badly they're doing. Am I right in saying that actually a vast majority of countries haven't even come up with a national action plan yet?
Yes, there is still a lack of presenting the updated national biodiversity plans. So that's one thing that it's need to be discussed in this COP and need to be pushed for the next COP17.
Yeah, I mean, because the plan was to have 30% of land, 30% of sea on a nation's territory protected by 2030. So if you're saying, you know, we're going to have to wait until the next meeting, the next COP in a couple of years, I mean, that's going to be leaving it very, very late, isn't it?
In next COP, they have to present results that they have done during these years. So the time is short, as you say. The time is going very fast. And governments and the society needs to make a very deep reflection on how we are doing. There is no time. And climate is changing and biodiversity is losing every day.
Colombia is also, according at least to Global Witness, the environmental advocacy group, it's the deadliest country for environmental activists. 79 were killed in the last year. It suggests that not everybody supports these moves to protect the environment.
Yes, that's very sad and it's a shame for our country and it's a reality. And that's why now in this COP, we are calling for a Peace with Nature coalition in order to connect the needs to protect the environment, but also human rights and also environmental justice. We recognize that our country is still suffering for conflicts, many countries in different areas of the country, and we need to address those conflicts and we need to protect the environmental leaders. I think this is the opportunity to put the environmental protection of those leaders in the public and in strategic and political agenda in the world.
And that was Ximena Puyana from the UNDP in Colombia speaking to me from that summit. That's it from NewsHour.